It all began with Hemingway, as so many things do. Specifically, with The Sun Also Rises, or, as the Brits call it, Fiesta. The latter title being apposite because part of what I carried away from that book in my youth was the sense that drinking wine was cool and sophisticated. And let's face it, this is one of the reasons we read books, especially in our youth, particularly books by Hemingway and Kerouac and Lawrence Durrell, to find out how to live and how to pose and where to travel and what to eat and drink and smoke along the way. Everybody in Hemingway's first novel is drinking wine. Not long after my vicarious adventures in Pamplona, this sense of wine as an appurtenance of the well-lived life was reinforced by Evelyn Waugh's Brideshead Revisited, with Charles Ryder and Sebastian Flight picturesquely draining the cellar at that estate over the course of a summer. I was so fixated on the wine and the scenery that I don't think I bothered to grasp the nature of their friendship. Not very Hemingway-esque, but again, for some reason, I remember the wine. The fact that wine had no place on my parents' suburban dining table seemed to confirm its consumption as a mark of sophistication. They and their friends drank cocktails, martinis, Manhattans, old fashions, and stingers. And when they drank enough of them, they behaved badly, especially when they were in their stingers period, though this didn't strike me as romantic or chic. Much later, I realized they were acting like the people in John Cheever stories once I finally got around to reading them. In fact, it took me years to appreciate his writing, in part because his characters resembled my parents and their friends. Hemingway was a great fan of Spanish Rosado, which might be why, on my very first date at the age of 16, I ordered a bottle of Matus Rosé, the spritzy Portuguese pink that came in a Buddha-shaped bottle. Never have I felt quite so worldly as I did that night at the Log Cabin restaurant in Lenox, Massachusetts, as I sniffed the cork and nodded to the waiter. Many of my college romances were initiated over a bottle of Chateauneuf du Pape, the only red wine whose name I could remember. But while lurching toward adulthood, I preferred quicker fixes, partly in the semi-conscious belief, suggested by so much of my reading, that the road of excess would lead to the palace of wisdom, that the pursuit of an artistic career as a writer required a strictly Dionysian regimen. Manhattan in the early 80s was a congenial venue for this aesthetic program, especially if your role models included Baudelaire, Dylan Thomas, Keith Richards, and Tom Verlaine. I worked at menial editorial jobs and briefly as a fact-checker for The New Yorker, as I did my best to infiltrate the downtown nightclub scene, which I imagined to be the contemporary equivalent of Isherwood's Berlin or Lautrec's Montmartre. Not long after I was fired by The New Yorker, I was awakened at the crack of 2 p.m. by a call from my best friend, who informed me that Raymond Carver was en route to my apartment. You could have knocked me over with a rolled-up $20 bill, several of which were lying on my bedside table. Jesus Christ, Raymond Carver on my doorstep? Granted, there was some context here. My best friend, Gary Fiskejohn, a junior editor at Random House, had reviewed a chapbook by Carver for the Village Voice, and, through his legendary champion, Gordon Lish, had gotten to know him. He would later become Carver's editor, as well as my own. Some years before, when we were at Williams College, I lent Gary a book called Will You Please Be Quiet, Please, and since then, we had both been passionate Carver fans. Now, Gary was returning the favor with interest. They had lunch together, and Carver had nothing to do until his reading at Columbia that evening, so Gary volunteered my services as a tour guide for the afternoon, assuming that I would be thrilled. Which I was, despite an apocalyptic headache. The buzzer rang, an indistinct mumble came through the intercom, and then the doorway was filled by this hulking, slouching bear whom I ushered into a tiny Greenwich Village apartment that showed all the signs of an arduous, recently terminated binge. We never got around to touring the city and instead talked for 4 or 5 hours, mostly about writing, until it was well past time to get Carver to his reading. At some point, he said, almost apologetically, "I don't know, the life you're living here doesn't seem exactly conducive to writing." While it didn't take a master storyteller to make this observation, from him it sounded like an epiphany. Carver knew whereof he spoke, a devotee of Alcoholics Anonymous who credited that organization with saving his life. 6 months later, I moved to Syracuse to study with Ray and clean up my act.